And our final case this morning is Foster v. the United States, case number 12-1961. Ms. Sturm.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Cheryl Sturm for the appellant, Lance Foster. Mr. Foster is asking the Court to conduct a de novo review of the record in this matter and to determine the trial counsel was ineffective at the critical plea bargaining stage and that Mr. Foster was prejudiced. We're asking the Court to vacate and remand criminal matter for an opportunity for Mr. Foster to take the second amended plea agreement. Trial counsel did not investigate the facts and did not explain the advantages and disadvantages of a plea agreement with a 10-year mandatory minimum. And the evidence is that trial counsel did not explain to Mr. Foster that if Foster did not accept the plea agreement, it was very likely the government would file an 851 special information that would increase the mandatory minimum sentence from 10 years to 20 years. The evidence supports a reasonable probability that had trial counsel been effective at the plea bargaining stage, Mr. Foster would have accepted the plea bargain and would have received a sentence of less than 20 years. And after Lafler, any increased sentence, any additional jail time triggers Sixth Amendment.
The second amended plea agreement would have provided for what kind of a guideline range?
Well, the plea agreement itself contains a stipulation to an enhancement for the gun and a stipulation to 1.5 kilograms of cocaine base. And Mr. Cupsis's calculation was the guidelines would be 235, I think, to 297.
Mm-hmm. So the theory, I understand that 5 months in prison is not a picnic, but that's probably the biggest difference in outcome, right?
Well, not necessarily. First of all, Mr. Cupsis also testified that he had got stipulations were not binding on the court. At the time the second plea agreement came into effect, Booker had been decided. The guidelines were merely advisory. The probation officer who prepared the pre-sentence investigation report calculated guidelines of 135 to 168.
That was after trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
After remarkable results achieved for Mr. Foster, right?
Well, Mr. Foster.
The testimony was that basically everybody seemed to think that the counsel had done one heck of a job in getting him acquitted on the conspiracy count, right?
The problem is it didn't make any difference in Mr. Ultimately, it didn't make a difference in Mr. Foster's sentence necessarily.
Okay. My point, though, is that the post-trial guideline calculation was never an alternative available to Mr. Foster at a time when he could have decided whether to accept a plea agreement.
That's correct. Okay. But I'm going to get into what Mr. Foster didn't know and what Mr. Foster did know at the time. And so what we're looking at, I think, Your Honor, is you're inquiring into the prejudice component for Mr. Foster, which the district court found against Mr. Foster on that issue. However, I would like to point out to this panel that what the judge does not consider is the objective. He said the only basically the only objective evidence was Mr. Foster's self-serving statement that he would have accepted the plea bargain had he known that his mandatory minimum could have been increased to 20 years after the filing of an 851 information. That opinion does not consider the fact that the objective evidence that Mr. Foster had signed and entered into a plea agreement, a less favorable plea agreement than the one that had the capped 20-year. There was a plea.
Right, but he backed out of that one, right? Hmm.
But he did enter into the plea agreement. Not every criminal defendant enters into a plea agreement. A defendant more inclined to plead guilty enters into a plea agreement. Doesn't consider as an objective evidence that Mr. Foster entered, proffered with the government. Certainly making it far more difficult to go to trial after you proffered than a defendant.
Did he sign the plea agreement less favorable than the second amended plea agreement?
The first plea agreement did not contain a cap of 20 years. It contained the same I think, stipulations as to the gun and the quantity of drugs, but there was no cap.
Okay.
There was no cap of 20 years there.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Kupsis also testified that at the very beginning of their interaction, Mr. Foster was interested in pleading guilty. So this was not a defendant that was, from the very beginning, determined to go to trial on this. The judge's opinion does not consider the difference in the sentence available with the plea versus the sentence that was actually imposed. Now, under the capped plea agreement, although the cap was 20 years and the guidelines, as explained by Mr. Kupsis, began at 235 months, Mr. Kupsis did testify that he felt he had mitigating circumstances to argue, but that he couldn't once there was a conviction after trial and a 20-year mandatory minimum imposed. He made an estimate that he thought he could have gotten the sentence down as low as 17 and a half years, which is certainly a substantial difference between 20 years. The capped plea agreement made the stipulations only advisory and did not compel the judge. And after Booker, the judge could not have been compelled to adhere to those guidelines. So I think that, on the whole, there is substantial additional objective evidence that Mr. Foster would have accepted the plea had he known all the facts. It also doesn't consider the testimony of Mr. Kupsis, and since Mr. Kupsis was found to be more credible, I'm focusing on his testimony, that Mr. Foster was more concerned about the mandatory minimum than he was about the maximum.
And I thought it was the other way around.
No, he was more concerned about the maximum sentence, I'm sorry, than about the mandatory minimum sentence, because even Mr. Foster could see there was no chance of being found not guilty on count 7, which was the possession with intent to distribute the cocaine base of 127 grams. So it was not just a recording. There was actual videotape of the undercover operative going in and making the purchase, watching Mr. Foster cook the crack cocaine. So there was no possibility that Mr. Foster was going to go to trial because he thought he was going to be acquitted on all the charges. And also in this instance, the court has to consider that after Glover, any increase in the sentence cannot be a bar to a showing of prejudice. So it's our position that there was substantial objective evidence that Mr. Foster, if properly advised, could have been persuaded to plead guilty.
Ms. Sturm, can I ask you this?
Sure.
One of the things the district judge relied on was the fact that when the defendant, Mr. Foster, did learn of the 851 information and the new 20-year mandatory minimum, he didn't do anything to try to change course at that point. 851 informations can be and are withdrawn. Should we consider that part of the district court's reasoning erroneous?
I think more that it's incomplete, Your Honor, and I'm prepared to address that. First of all, there's no evidence in the record whatsoever that this plea agreement could have been resuscitated. We introduced a letter that accompanied the plea agreement from the government that gave an expiration date for the plea agreement, and that had passed. Now, I'd like to get into what Mr. Kupsis also didn't tell Mr. Foster, what information Mr. Foster did not have on this critical decision at the time Mr. Kupsis claims he said, should I go and see if we can get this back? Okay, Mr. Kupsis did not have a specific recollection that he told Foster that under the agreement, the government would have to request the minimum sentence under the guidelines. Okay, he had no specific recollection that he ever gave Mr. Foster the information that if he took this capped plea, the government was required to request the minimum sentence. There's no testimony that Mr. Kupsis told Foster that the stipulations in the capped plea were not binding on the judge. Mr. Kupsis never explained to Foster that he could get guidelines as low as 135 to 168 and focused on the sentence of 235 under the agreement. And what Mr. Foster's testimony was is he came to me, he said, I had a capped plea, and it was the same as my co-defendant had gotten, and that's basically what he told me, that I could get a capped plea of 20 years. And Mr. Cupps has testified that his whole focus was on the upper end. You can, if you don't take this, you can get a life sentence. If you don't take this, you can get a life sentence. If you don't take this, you can get a life sentence. And Mr. Foster, who's the defendant, is looking at the concept still of, if I don't get these enhancements, what sentence could I get? Okay, certainly when the plea is still on the table, at that point he believes he could get his sentence down as low as 10 years if he fought these enhancements, if he fought the gun, if he fought the quantity of drugs for which he was held accountable. He only had a 10-year mandatory minimum before the 851 information was filed.
Ms. Sturm, your time has expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Haller.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The District Court in this case concluded that no plea agreement was entered because of Foster's complete unwillingness to plead guilty rather than because of any erroneous advice as to the mandatory minimum. On this record, that finding was correct, and it should not be disturbed. I think among the key facts in this case are the fact, as you pointed out, Judge Hamilton, that Foster would not plead even after the 851 enhancement was filed. And Mr. Cupps has testified that he went to Foster and told him, I still think we should try to go enter a plea, either to the 20 years or to try and see if we can get this withdrawn. And Foster had no interest whatsoever. I mean, the other thing that's interesting in this case, Your Honor, is Foster's testimony essentially was, if I had known from the get-go that this was out there, I would have taken the first plea agreement, the less favorable plea agreement. And Foster also testified that no advice was ever given to me about the first plea agreement. I was never shown the second plea agreement. And the district court was certainly in the position, the district court rightly granted an evidentiary hearing on this case, but the district court was well within its rights to determine after that evidentiary hearing that Foster was not credible. Some defendants are logical actors and some are not. Some want to roll the dice and go to trial no matter what the odds are against them. And the district court that had the opportunity to observe Mr. Cupps, who practiced before him, who tried the case before him, and Foster, who had been sentenced by him and who testified before him, and to consider the testimony of both of them and to determine which one was credible. And that's, I expect that in light of Lafler and Missouri versus Frye, there probably are going to be more of these cases and more of these evidentiary hearings. But it's now in the province of the district court to review these. And in some instances, it may well turn out that the information mattered, and in other instances, it will turn out that it didn't. In this particular case, as Mr. Cupps has pointed out, the reality was we can look all we want in hindsight, but this was a somewhat startling result. I mean, the evidence was overwhelming that Mr. Foster was involved in this conspiracy, that he was on Title III recordings. Two witnesses testified against him. There was plenty of evidence. At the same time, the jury accepted it. And so one can also sort of sit there, as opposing counsel suggested, and say, well, the evidence was completely overwhelming. There was no way that the defendant was going to be acquitted on the possession count, but one never knows. I mean, there was a defense that was mounted in this case as to the possession count, and the defense essentially was, you know, you can't really tell too much from the tape. The defendant turned over, or the confidential informant turned over two baggies, and yet one of the reports suggests there was only one baggie, and how do we know that what he turned over wasn't just this little 4-gram bag of crack instead of the quantity? I mean, had that happened, then the higher possession count would not even have come into effect. So it's not as if one can sit there and say that the defendant, no defendant would have rejected this plea agreement. Maybe no defendant in their right mind would have rejected this plea agreement, but the district court was within its rights to find that the defendant wasn't. The defendant wasn't in his right mind, and the defendant on these facts was not prejudiced.
Mr. Haller, could I ask you, we have some cases, and the district judge cited them and followed them, that say you need objective evidence of prejudice in these kinds of cases of foregone guilty pleas and ineffective assistance of counsel. Could you comment on whether you think that requirement of, quote, objective evidence is consistent with Strickland, which does not impose that requirement more generally for ineffective assistance of counsel claims?
Well, I think this court has basically had that requirement, I think, since Johnson versus Duckworth, which I know this court's familiar with. But I don't think that this is the case to necessarily.
You look at who argued that case.
I do know who argued that case, Your Honor. I'm familiar with that. That said, I don't think this is the case to necessarily revisit that. I don't think that that's something that the court really needs to delve into. I do think that as far as that case seems to me, it says if the only thing that the defendant has is their self-serving statement, they almost can't even get in the door. But that's not this case. In this case, the district court said you can get in the door. You can get an evidentiary hearing. We've looked at the facts, and there's more. There is some surrounding circumstance that suggests maybe there's something here. But beyond that, there's not enough here. So the question of whether that alone would be enough, you know, in this case, there is more than just sufficient objective evidence. There just isn't enough on the final record for the defendant to prevail in this case. I mean, this ultimately is a fact-driven case, not a law-driven case, Your Honor, and I recognize that this is de novo as to the ultimate legal conclusion, but it's clear error as to the facts. And the factual finding that the defendant is incredible and that Mr. Koops' testimony was credible.
Well, even apart from that clear credibility finding in favor of the attorney as against Mr. Foster, the evidence is undisputed, I think, that the gun issue and the drug quantity issue were sort of non-negotiables for him or deal breakers for him, that he wasn't going to give up on those.
Well, I mean, his testimony, if it had been accepted, was had I been told that my mandatory minimum could go for 10 to 20, I would have folded the deck and I would have just admitted these things. So, I mean, I suppose if the district court had said, I find that the attorney's not credible and the defendant is, he'd get in the door.
Right, but once we've got that credibility finding,
game is over, yes. Once the credibility finding comes in, yes. The defendant, Mr. Koops has said, I kept telling him he was going to get life. I really thought he was going to get life. So from our perspective, I'm not even sure that there's prejudice here, or I'm sorry, that there's cause here. I mean, I think all we've ever really asked of defense attorneys is to, you know, project what's going to be relevant, to make an honest prediction as to what the sentence is and what the relevant factors are. There was no, you know, I mean, what was clear from the government's perspective, Your Honor, was that this was non-negotiable. This was our final offer. He had to accept the drug quantity. He had to accept the weapons enhancement. And if those are in play, then the guideline was 235 to 293 under the first agreement and was 235 to 240 under the second agreement because of the 20-year ceiling. So these arguments about 135 to 168 and all of that, I acknowledge that this is a post-Booker case, of course, and so there is some possibility that the defendant under the second plea agreement could have pled his case to the court for a lower sentence. But again, on dealing on the cause side, the defense attorney was there to say Judge Lozano sticks very close to the guidelines, stuck closer to the guidelines in 2006 than he does today.
Was there testimony to that effect?
There is in the record, Your Honor, there was testimony that he informed the defendant that Judge Lozano sticks to the guidelines and that he thought that with the guidelines at 19.5, the best the defendant could get was 17.5, that it was unlikely that the judge would go below that. I mean, he could have been wrong about that prediction as well, but all we ask of defense attorneys is not that they be fortune tellers, but that they make their best and honest prediction as to what the ultimate sentence is going to be. And he did that. He made his best and honest prediction, which is if you take this plea, your sentence is going to be between 17.5 and 19.5 years. If you go to trial, my honest prediction is your sentence is going to be life, because my prediction is you're going to be convicted of the conspiracy count. And then it's not just about how much drugs are you responsible for, it's how much drugs is the conspiracy responsible for. And as you know as well, Judge Hamilton, from the evidence in the Tanner case, this was a massive conspiracy. This was a conspiracy that was dealing, you know, at least $100,000 worth of drugs a week for many years. There was no question he was going to be held responsible for 1.5 kilograms worth of drugs, and probably also could have gotten some kind of leader, organizer, manager, supervisor enhancement as a middleman in the conspiracy. And there was testimony in the record about him having a weapon as well. So he was unwilling to take the plea because of those enhancements. He also, I believe, Mr. Koops has testified, he just felt he was Mr. Tanner's best friend. He didn't want to plead. He didn't want to cooperate. He thought that Tanner had gotten into his head to tell him that he could beat this. And defendants often go to trial irrationally. And I think the evidence is that this defendant did that. And under those circumstances, he doesn't have the chance to go back now and accept a plea he rejected.
Mr. Holler, speaking of rationality, what was the U.S. Attorney's rationale for waiting so long, literally the eve of trial, to file the 851 enhancement, as opposed to filing it at the time the indictment was returned or at arraignment?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I mean, there's nothing in the record on that point. The trial attorney did switch in this case near the end, and I'm not sure if it was something that was overlooked in his criminal history initially or if it was something that was brought in. The fact that it was not discussed with defense counsel tends to suggest to me that it's the latter, but I do not know the answer to that question as to why it was brought in at the last minute. I mean, we do criminal history checks and those kinds of things on all of our witnesses and everyone at the last minute. But I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. And I guess that brings in another point as well, which is that you know, Mr. Kupsis doesn't know whether the government has overlooked this, whether they're holding it back pending trial. I mean, that was the testimony as well. It's hard for him to predict and accurately advise a client, you need to take this because the government might not, maybe they aren't aware of it, maybe they overlooked it. I mean, those are questions to ask as well. So again, I think that the court can easily resolve this on prejudice like the district court did, but I don't know. I think that the court could also resolve it on cause and should be careful to we do not believe that the defendant has necessarily even proved cause in this case. For all those reasons, we believe that the judgment of the district court should be affirmed.
Thank you. Ms. Sturm, your time had expired, but I'll give you a minute in rebuttal if you have anything further to add.
I don't know how the government can argue in good faith that Mr. Foster got the best and honest prediction from his attorney when the attorney never told him that his mandatory minimum could be doubled with an 851 information. There was absolutely no testimony in the record that there was any discussion whatsoever between the defense counsel and Mr. Foster about the 851 information. It was never mentioned to Mr. Foster before the plea agreement expired, and the government has no testimony to that effect. The defendant was left with the impression, even at the time Mr. Kupsis raised the issue, should we see if we can get this plea back, that he couldn't get less than 235 months with the plea agreement. And that is not accurate. He could have gotten less than 235 months. As far as arguing about the gun enhancement and the quantity of drugs, even if he won those, he couldn't get less than 20 years. That was obviously not clearly explained to Mr. Foster, because Mr. Kupsis' testimony is, all I was focusing on is you're going to get life if you don't do this, you're going to get life, you're going to get life, not what's the bottom. You know, what's the point in fighting about the gun and the quantity of drugs? If you win it, you can't do any better than the capped plea. And that's what the advice that Mr. Foster was left with. Mr. Kupsis was ineffective in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And Ms. Sturm, you were appointed counsel in this case, no? All right. Well, you have our thanks, as you do as well, Mr. Holler. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and that concludes the